My name is Eric Bowe, and welcome to the Primal Shopper Podcast. This podcast is for marketers, entrepreneurs, and academics interested in understanding why we shop the way we do. My goal is to focus on primal motivations driving our behaviors and how to apply the learnings to improve your marketing. Don't worry about taking notes. I will include any links in the show notes. Also, there's plenty of bonus content on primalshopper.com. Finally, if you want a more in-depth perspective, you'll find it in my book, Primal Shopper, which is available on Amazon and other booksellers. Okay, now let's get on with the episode. Well, if you follow me on LinkedIn, you already know the good news. My book released last week. To celebrate the reveal, what I want to do is four successive podcasts reviewing the four sections within the book. The goal of each one of these podcasts is sort of giving an idea of the contents of the book and have some fun with it. I'll read a little bit from the book. I'll share some stories that didn't make it into the book. I want to talk about the inspiration behind different topics within the book, different chapters, and finally, talk about additional insights that are either not in the book or quite honestly have occurred since the book has been completed. So the first section of the book is titled Identifying the Primal Shopper. This section begins with a quote, and I put a quote at the beginning of many of the chapters just to crystallize the idea I'm about to get into. And in this case, it's a quote from Enrico Fermi. And he's quoted as saying, "There's two possible outcomes. If the result confirms the hypothesis, then you made a discovery. If the result is contrary to the hypothesis, then you made a discovery." This quote is meaningful to me because it's sort of portrays the discovery I made, and just as importantly, the discoveries that are not in the book. And I typically like starting with a hypothesis and then just see if it works out. Sometimes it does, and we'll get into some that did in this book and throughout this book. Sometimes it doesn't, but that doesn't mean you don't learn something, and that doesn't mean you didn't make a discovery. So with that said, what I want to do is just read a few paragraphs that kick off this first section, both to give you an idea of what's in the section, and also sort of sets up this podcast quite nicely. So I write, "I did not set out on a journey to discover shopper DNA. In retrospect, I played around the periphery of the idea for over a decade. There was a lot going on in the world, in my life. There was a dot-com boom which energized the advertising industry. Anything seemed possible. It was as if we were inventing a new paradigm to do business, or so we thought. This was followed by the dot-com bust. The new paradigm turned to dust, or it seemed at the time. But in the ashes, there was a continual stream of new digital channels. YouTube launched the video revolution. Facebook took social media to another level. And mobile tech meant we were always connected. The digital wave swept through our lives, and I rode a lot of the wave throughout the 2000s. But something nagged at me from a personal and business perspective. You see, I have two passions in business, shopper behavior and organizational behavior. The dot-com wave was a series of shiny objects. Some succeeded, many failed. At the center of success or failure lies the ability of the inventor to interpret the psyche of the individual. If the inventor understood individuals' behaviors, the digital experience amplified human nature and was a success. On the other hand, tech innovations frequently overestimated people's ability to change, and as a result, fell by the wayside. Regardless of outcome, understanding human behavior and adaptation were a critical aspect of the digital wave. At times during this decade-long wave, I saw glimpses of behavioral patterns, consistencies in how people behave. There was something there, but I didn't know how far-reaching those patterns were. Then, through a period of trial and error, I came up with the concept of shopper DNA. It didn't happen overnight. Some hypotheses led to blind alleys. Others brought positive results. This section discusses in detail the discovery of shopper DNA, the inspiration, the hypotheses, the blind alleys, and the final results. So this short passage sort of crystallizes what's in the first section of the book. What I would like to do now is just sort of get into several different topics within it and just have a little fun with it. You know, so for example, the first topic I'd like to talk about is, I title it The Inspiration. Now, when I came up with it, and actually it's not only in the book, in the first podcast I did, I talked about the inspiration behind shopper DNA. And there's two things that I bring up. a Myers-Briggs workshop that I went to when I was at Organic, and then this behavioral study I did on Shell roughly about a decade ago. What I don't want to do is repeat those stories. Rather, I'd like to just talk about several key takeaways from them. First off, the Myers-Briggs really inspired this retail hypothesis for myself. First of all, looking at Myers-Briggs, which measures a person's preference when dealing with the outside world, it made me wonder if people prefer a certain natural state to exist in, and when they're not in it, they become stressed, then does that exist within the shopping category? Does that exist in the retail space? So the hypothesis was really testing this idea that we all have a preference for how we prefer, right, preference for how we want to shop. This is sort of the core hypothesis that the core hypotheses, excuse me, that nagged me for years on how would you do that. And there were some fits and starts, but it wasn't really till I got to that Shell study that the light bulb went on, that the second hypothesis occurred. The term I like to use is called the triangle of tension. And if you remember the story from the first podcast or in the book, I talk about one of the heads of marketing at Shell felt they already had the answer. They didn't see a necessity to do any additional primary research. I said, well, that's great. Tell me what the answer is. We don't want to waste your money doing research you don't need to do. He says it's simple. It's price, quality, and convenience. Those are the three factors. People decide on price, they will decide on quality, they will decide on convenience. In many respects, he was right, but those three words are not actionable. First off, you need to have a deeper understanding. For example, price does motivate people to do things without a doubt. However, there's different price sensitivity points. Some people, when they're feeling, they'll act at 5 cents. Some people act at a penny. Some people won't even act at all. So just saying price matters doesn't help you with pricing psychology or your pricing strategy. Convenience is another one. Some people are unwilling to make a left turn into a gas station. Other people will drive by station after station just because they don't see pumps available. They don't care about price. It's all about immediate access and getting in and out. Quality, which is the last part of the tension triangle, is really baffling to me in many respects because Shell does create a superior quality fuel, without a doubt. I learned that when I worked on it, and I firmly believe it. However, quality is about perception. In a study done, I believe it was by MPD, what they found out was that Costco had the number two quality fuel per consumers. Chevron was number one, and I think Shell was at four or five. Now, again, this isn't some chemistry test. This is perception. And I found that very interesting that the quality often, in this case, was a rub-off of the Costco brand. People don't know what brand Costco is buying or what they're putting in their tank. They do believe, because there's many quality products in Costco, that their fuel must be at similar quality. That was the first part of getting deeper, but then it was even bigger after that. Because the funny part about that tension triangle, price, quality, convenience, and in the old adage in businesses, you can pick two, not three. Well, in the consumer world, guess what? We could be motivated by one, two, or three. And this was pronounced in the Shell study because when you looked at their eight segments, what occurred was every single segment was influenced somewhat by price. There was a quality sensitivity. There was a convenience sensitivity. When I looked at the collective results, it was evident there was something more going on here. And this is sort of what sort of got me into thinking about it really looked like shopper DNA. So if I took a step back, and if I look beyond the fueling category, is there a set of DNA that is persistent across multiple categories? This gets me to the second subject I talk about in the first section, which is the discovery itself and finding this DNA that's across multiple categories. In order to do this, a group of us really focused on what I'll call personal trade-offs because it isn't do you want quality? It isn't do you want to save money? It isn't do you want to save time? Logically, most people would like things the cheapest, the quickest, and the highest quality. But the real world is a little more complicated than that. The retail environment is about trade-offs. So we were looking for questions that really looked at these trade-offs that really tested and highlighted the DNA within the shoppers. An example is this core question that's within the study. And what we do is we ask it for every single product category. When buying this product, do you spend money to save time or do you spend time to save money? This question is a great example of what I would call a tension question. It really makes that person filling out the survey decide when they're shopping for a product, what's more important. This is the crux of what we're trying to do to build out the survey, is find these questions that truly correlated to behavior. As you can imagine, finding a series of questions that really isolated and predicted the behaviors of people took some time. We had a group of people that really helped out with this: Sue LaRue from Insight Scout, Raquel Eckney, Carl Heller, John Snyder, that really helped out working through hypotheses, testing a lot of questions. It was a pretty intense year. We did a lot of different things, but the core of it was using surveys and shopper diaries to compare results. So there was many interviews done to make sure that the survey results actually matched a person's real-world behavior. The diaries in particular illuminated different aspects that you just didn't get out of a survey. And several examples of this. One was of this younger woman who was going through her two-week shop or retail history. And what we asked people to do was every time you went shopping, record it in a diary, save the receipt, and there were some other things we asked them to do in addition to that. In this case, she was talking about when she went into a retail store, how she got a great deal on shoes. Then she proceeded to tell us the shoes only cost her $300. Now, probably the female people listening to this podcast would go, well, it's probably some high-end brand of shoes. To me, $300 doesn't seem like a deal no matter what type of shoes. But the story gets to the dynamics of really what a deal is and saving money is. It is the perceived quality. So it was very important as we looked at surveys within different product categories that we looked also at how does it fit with brand? How does you do the valuation? What is the price sensitivity? Another story was about a person who did their grocery shopping. And we asked everybody to do a grocery shopping trip because it was a key aspect of most people's lives. She turned in a receipt from Walgreens. We said, well, okay, that's nice, but where's your grocery shopping receipt? And she said, this is it. Honestly, we were a little baffled until she actually told us the following. I hate grocery shopping. In fact, she hated it so much, she was willing to pay extra money just to spend the least amount of time within the retail environment. In many respects, this diary story foreshadowed something we found out in later studies, that when you look at time and mission versus a journey shopper, mission meaning I want to get in and out as quickly as possible, journey is more of I like to explore things within the environment, really is related to hate and love. Mission shoppers hate, journey shoppers love. So it was an interesting foreshadowing of where we ended up in several surveys down the road. The next topic I want to discuss is what did we find? After all that analysis, the correlation came down to three DNA strands. Wallet, meaning you're spending time to save money. Time, love it or hate it, as I just mentioned with the Walgreens example. And brand. And brand is interesting because initially we thought brand was loyalty, but no, it's something different. It means brand matters. It means that when I go buy a product, I will only buy a brand I recognize. Now I can find that brand as a part of my journey, but I'm not buying a brand that I have no idea what it is. And that's really where you get into brand versus a free agent who really doesn't care about the brand. Something else is more important. And that's the DNA, wallet, time, and brand. But that's also just the tip of the iceberg. Remember the tension triangle I talked about with Shell? Let's bring that back into focus, because what we also found out as we stacked up wallet, time, and brand is that shoppers in all product categories had a mix of these. Some people did operate totally on wallet or time or brand, but many shoppers did a combination of wallet, time, and brand. And if you sort of break out the different combinations, you end up with eight archetypes or eight typologies. For example, if you're a shopper that is a brand citizen, meaning brand matters, you're a deal seeker, and you're on a mission, The archetype is called a brand tracker. The brand tracker prefers specific brand, wants a deal, and doesn't want to waste time shopping for it. Brands influence these shoppers, however, they are not willing to pay full price. The brand tracker gravitates towards the deal for their brands. They will spend time finding the best price and deal prior to going into the store. They pre-plan because they do not enjoy shopping, and their preference is to get a deal on their brand as quickly as possible. Another example of an archetype is a deal surgeon. The deal surgeon is a free agent, deal seeker, and also on a mission. The best way of explaining a deal surgeon is to consider the Black Friday shopper. Black Friday is a competition to save the most on limited deals. Shoppers better have a plan or they will lose out. The deal surgeon thrives in this environment. This typology has an acute desire to save money, and they do not leave anything to chance, identifying what they need, who has the best deals, and then they go in, get what they want, and get out. In the book, I talk about the 8 different target types. These are just 2 examples I'm giving you right now. One thing I'd like to bring up at this point is I use this term tension triangle, because the idea here is this tension between the 3 DNA strands is causing an acute behavior. While I do believe this to be true, somebody who is a deal surgeon, for example, that's their natural behavior. That's not forced. That is how they prefer to shop. And if they have to shop a different way, it will actually increase their stress level within the retail environment. So while tension is used as a hypothesis here, the way it actually works in the real world within shoppers is less about tension, more about a natural state of how we prefer to shop. So once we found, tested, and landed on the DNA, we created a series of surveys. Some were done in Omnibus, some were done for specific clients. What I did in the book is I included 5 different types of surveys. One is for quick serve restaurants. I did one for fast casual restaurants, fast casual like Panera, Five Guys Burgers, Qdoba. There's a mobile phone survey in there, a dog food survey, and then finally a hotel survey. The idea is most of them are in the appendix, so one is up front, but the rest are in the appendix. You can take the survey yourself, and you can compare to the results of the survey that we actually did. One thing worth noting is that the reason I'm including the survey in here is so if you desire, you can include it in your own marketing to get an idea of what your customers are like for your brand and relate that to what they are like for the category. Because that delta between your brand and your category will help you understand what your potential growth is from a shopper share perspective. The next subject I'd like to touch on is a little bit about this natural state I talked about, and it's not tension, it's really what you prefer to do. So there's this whole concept in the book I sort of explore briefly, and it's called nature versus nurture. Because it became sort of like with the Myers-Briggs, I do believe you are born with it, although maybe your Myers-Briggs could shift over time, but most likely I would think that it would stay pretty consistent if you took studies every so often. However, is that really the case? Are you born with this shopper DNA? Or was it part of an environmental conditioning that occurred? An example of this is my father. He was born during the Great Depression and grew up in a very frugal society because people didn't have a lot. And you could argue this impacted him later on in life. Now, growing up, I had 4 brothers and myself, so 5 boys, and my father worked at General Motors, so it was a single income. So it's not like we had a lot of money lying around where we could do whatever we want. Needless to say, my parents really watched their money to make sure we could make ends meet and do some things as a family that they wanted to do. What's interesting, though, is later on in life, when we all moved out, my father still had that frugality ingrained in him. Now, I don't know if it was part of the growing up in the Great Depression or if it was a function of having a large family to take care of on a single income. Which sort of gets me to a second story, sort of in the same vein. And I talk about this person in the book. Her name is Monica. She's the wife of a friend of mine. And I always found her intriguing because if you ever looked up deal seeker in a dictionary, I swear to God, it would be her face. She lived to save money, everything she did. And actually, it would bother her if she didn't. As a part of writing this book, I went over to their house and did a 4-hour interview with her because I was just amazed with the different stories she would tell me on how they save money. Now, They weren't cheap. In fact, she'd be the first person to tell you she saves money on quality items. In the course of this interview, it came to a point where it seemed like they saved on every major item in their home. Finally, I asked, "Did you ever pay retail for a major item in your home?" And there was a long pause. Joe and Monica, Joe is Monica's husband, sat there and thought about it for a second. And then finally, Joe got excited and said, "Oh, yeah, that Weber grill you bought me for my birthday last year. You paid full price for that." She goes, "No, nope, I didn't." And I go, "Really? You didn't? Because Weber isn't known for deals. Weber is pretty much consistent prices." She goes, "Well, what I did is I went into Lowe's, and while I was in there, I got the salesperson from Home Depot on the phone, and I played them against each other till I got a better deal on the Weber grill in Lowe's." And I went, "All right, that's very intriguing." The conversation with her eventually shifted to, "Well, what about your family? What about your parents? Do they have the same demeanor? What about your siblings?" Well, her father had a lot of the same shopping traits that Monica did. In fact, her father kept a diary about all the major items that he bought. He was very precise with it. However, her sisters and her mother, not so much. Look, I'm not a geneticist. I can't tell you whether it's inherited or consistent. It's just an interesting concept of nature versus nurture because are there retail environments out there that truly would change our DNA, or because we are born with this type of preference, regardless of the environment, we are going to stick to it. The last subject I want to cover in this podcast is the blind alleys. And I really like this subject because, believe it or not, some of the most fun I've had with this is these hypotheses where I tried things and it just didn't work out. And I still remember Sue would be often saying to me, "Well, that's not a DNA strand. What the heck are you doing? But let's prove it out. Let's just see what happens." So, like I said, not every DNA strand worked out. Several that didn't was one we had early on was called I Belong. And the idea behind I Belong was this idea of membership, whether it is loyalty programs, Costco memberships, club memberships, stuff like that. What we found out, though, there is really no broad-based correlation between this membership and other attributes when you crossed it with time, with money, and with brand. So that sort of fell by the wayside because it just wasn't there. We just didn't find anything. The next one that started out as a DNA strand was passion. Passion makes a lot of sense. And actually, passion does exist in the overall survey, but it's not a DNA strand. The reason is passion is highly subjective. Also, passion will vary by product category. And let me explain this a little bit. Let's take two different product categories, mobile phones and grocery shopping. Passion within mobile phones could be a combination of several things. It could be a passion for a specific brand like Apple. It could be passion because you're a tech enthusiast. You get the idea there. Juxtapose that with grocery shopping. Here, you could have passions for specific brands. You also could be a foodie or a chef, or you could have a passion for your family and wanting to feed them well, or you have a passion for fitness and you want to eat well. So passion does exist. It just wasn't a single DNA strand. So when we look at how passion is actually used in the survey, it is used as a series of questions relative to the product category, which begins with commoditization and goes up to personal passion. For example, let's talk about mobile phones. We begin with commodity here, and we ask a simple question, and it would go something like this for a mobile survey. To me, all mobile phones are pretty much the same. Surprisingly, within mobile phones, about a third of the people answered in the affirmative to this question. Commoditization, in many respects, is a red flag that branding isn't working in a category. And the higher the commoditization, the less brands can actually differentiate and have an impact on the purchase decision of shoppers. From commoditization, we look at several different things, and these aren't necessarily a hierarchy. These are just different questions we ask. We ask about brand advocacy. We ask about category passion. So with mobile phones, people could be passionate about their mobile phone or mobile phones in general. Also, we ask about personal passion. Definitely within mobile phones, you have the tech enthusiast who is interested in all forms of technology, one of which is their mobile phone. Each layer of this questioning gives you an idea of the personal attachment that respondent has with their mobile phone. Probably the most interesting part about passion is how it plays with your DNA set. More often than not, you will actually have two different sets of DNA in the retail environment. A DNA that is based on need. So for example, I need milk, I need laundry detergent, I need this. And if I'm a deal seeker, what you're going to see is that DNA, my shopper DNA, will be consistent across need categories. Then I get to what I'll call a want category, a desire category. For example, take somebody who's into personal fitness. There could be a chance that when they buy need-based products like laundry detergent, paper towel, things like that, they're going to look for the deal. However, because they're into fitness and eating well, when it comes to buying products that they eat or they consume, they will actually spend more money to get a superior product, possibly superior brands. So they'll tend to be more price blind than they will deal seeker. This example highlights how passion may affect your overall shopper DNA. There's two other blind alleys that are interesting. The first one is social. Originally, I had social as a strand, and there was four strands that we tested through different surveys. However, social ran from active to inactive. That sort of was the dichotomy within social. The reality with this is like it just didn't work, because what does actively social mean, or what does an inactive social person mean? In the end, it is still in the survey. It is still used. It's just not part of a core DNA, because what we found out was that social really was a 2x2 matrix. The first part of it was, did you use social to make the purchase? And the second part is, did you talk about your purchase afterwards? This splitting of social into before and afterwards worked out really nicely. We also combined this with looking at social threads and discussions online, which it became very powerful when you look at how, not just are you social, but what were the social threads out there that were impacting your decisions. Often what we found out with social was it was an amplification of your DNA. An example of this is deal seeking within the grocery category. It was very high, meaning that over 50% of the people were likely to share their grocery experience in the last couple of months. Reason being is people love to share how they save money. And some of it may be altruism, and meaning like, hey, if you go here, you'll do this. But many times, it's somebody who wants to be seen as an expert within finding the deal. And often, it's less about altruism, it's more about bragging rights, because what they want to do within their social circle is be seen as the person who can save the most money. The last blind alley I want to talk about is really not a blind alley. It's probably the number one question I get when I go through the shopper DNA, and that is, did you consider value as a DNA strand? The reality is, if you take a look at what is occurring here between brand, wallet, and time, that is a valuation, and your DNA sort of dictates how you value the retail environment, how you value buying a specific product. So while value is not a DNA strand, the entire primal shopper approach gives you an idea of how a shopper values a specific product, a specific brand. So value is inherent in the DNA and how we actually decipher it. Well, that pretty much wraps up the first section of the book. There will be three more episodes, just to foreshadow them a little bit. If I had to encapsulate today's discussion, I like to refer to it as the what, is what was found. In the next episode, it's about the why. And the why really goes into the explanation of brand, wallet, and time, and also social, and understanding the motivations behind those DNA strands. And I encapsulate those into 18 primal principles in the second section. The third section of the book, or the third part of the book, is titled Don't Paddle Upstream. And it really looks at, if you take the DNA and put it in the marketplace, how does it affect marketing tactics as they exist today? I probably could have titled this chapter also Marketing Kryptonite, because what I found out is based on certain DNA, certain tactics just don't work. So for some people, that will be a very eye-opening section. I finished the book, the fourth episode in this case, is about activating the primal shopper, where I discuss based on the DNA, based on the primal principles that I cover and the marketing environment, well, what do you do about it? How do you take this information and use it in your marketing? That gives you something to look forward to in the upcoming 3 podcasts. And I guess, well, that wraps up this episode. As always, first off, thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the podcast, I encourage you to subscribe to future podcasts on either primalshopper.com or your favorite podcasting service, Primal Shoppers, on iTunes, Spotify, Google. So please subscribe. Also, if you're looking to apply Primal Shopper to your marketing, feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have. Well, that's it for now. Until next time, this is Eric Bowe on the Primal Shopper Podcast.